This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and glad to have you with us. Since 9/11, the country's intelligence budget has grown by at least 250%. The American security state has grown so fast that no one really knows how many people it employs or how effective it is. This morning in this hour of Focus, our guest is Washington Post columnist William Arkin. He's been a columnist with the Post since 1998. He's advised the UN and the U.S. Air Force and has also worked at various nonprofit organizations. He's authored or co-authored more than a dozen books about U.S. military and national security. And he, along with another Washington Post reporter, Dana Priest, wrote a series of articles that were published in the Post about the American security state. Top Secret America was what it's called. In fact, you can still read the articles on the website of the Post. Together, they have also put this in an expanded version into a book that was published not very long ago. Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. It is published by Little Brown, if you'd like to read the book. And we'll be talking about some of the things that they found this morning in this hour of the show. That means questions and comments are welcome, as always. We do ask people to try to be brief, just so we can keep moving through the hour. But, of course, your questions are welcome. If you are in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so if it would be long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you want to be involved in a conversation, you can call or write. And Mr. Arkin, hello.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Hey, well, thanks very much for giving us your time. Just as a kind of a general question, if one looked at the budgets for the Pentagon, for the Department of Homeland Security, for the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, we tried to add all of that up. Everyone that has something to do now with national security, can you put a number on that?
Well, I suppose I can put a number on it. I would say it's probably somewhere close to $1 trillion a year. But no one can put a number on it, and that's one of the discoveries that Dana and I made in our long investigation, which is that the more that we tried to put facts around what had happened to the national security establishment after 9/11, the more that we discovered that no one at the top really had a handle on the entirety of the military intelligence and homeland security apparatus. I mean, at the time, the top official responsible for intelligence at the Pentagon, who's now the director of national intelligence, General Clapper, told us on the record that probably only God knew how many secrets there were and how many people had top secret clearances and how much money was being paid.
That's a stunning sort of admission for someone who is in that position, because that person is supposed to be the overseer of all security. That, and after 9/11, someone said, well, we really need a person in that job. And so that post was created. And if that person doesn't know, then one must truly say no one knows.
Well, I think that that's right. And it's really even worse than normal people imagine, which is to say that really one of the defining features of American national security since 9/11 has been the creation of new organizations, many of which didn't exist previously. The Department of Homeland Security is an example, which is now the third largest department of the U.S. government. And these organizations, you know, they've sort of been established in emergencies, with ad hoc authorities, with unclear mandates and agendas. And the thing that surprised Dana and I most as we continued our investigation was that even a decade later, even with a new administration, which was promising greater transparency and change, we found that really much of what had been created in this sort of ad hoc crisis stage after 9/11 persisted, and not only persisted, but practiced various methods to ensure that they were not going to be overseen or eliminated.
Mm-hmm. So, and another one of the things that you have written about is the great increase in the numbers of people with security clearance in the country. So it's with this growth of people, this is it is both a growth of employees in existing agencies. So I'm sure that there are more people working for the CIA and more people working for the NSA, but there are also branches. Well, I don't say branches of government entities, I guess, that are completely new, that before 9/11 they didn't exist.
That's correct. Now, not only that, really the most important structural change that occurred after 9/11 was the growth of contractors, private companies which were doing work on national security for the U.S. government. And here I'm not talking about people who are drivers or guards or cooks. I'm talking about people who are engaged in the substantive work of intelligence collection or even targeting. And what we discovered as we started to actually try to put together the very numbers that General Clapper didn't have, that Secretary Gates didn't have, was that of those people in the U.S. government who had been granted top secret clearances, so that's the highest level of clearance. You know, it's not something that's just given out. It requires a background investigation, and in the intelligence community, it requires a polygraph and constant counterintelligence scrutiny. That of those a million or so people who have top secret clearances in America, about a third work for private companies.
Mm-hmm.
And that just blew us away because, you know, we knew that there had been this enormous growth of contracting since 9/11. We knew that there were many contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan. But this was the core of the intelligence community, the core people who were working in the intelligence community. And that investment in giving them top secret clearances not only put them in very privileged positions, but I would argue put them in places where essentially it is supposed to, by law, be positions where only people who work directly for the United States government are supposed to be in.
Well, this point, I think, points to an important issue because, as you say, there has been quite a lot of attention focused on the fact that, say, after 9/11, there's been a great increase in the use of private contractors by the Pentagon, doing all kinds of things, but also carrying guns. And there have been a lot of concerns about accountability. There have been concerns about private contractors draining talent from the military because they can pay more than the military can. But maybe the big thing was, can you really be sure what it is these people are doing and how they're conducting business? And while that might be, you might say, well, that's certainly important when you're talking about the Pentagon, if you're talking about national security and the people who have access to very highly classified information, then if oversight is a problem, here it's going to be an even bigger problem.
It is going to be a bigger problem, and not just a bigger problem, but it really gives you some insights into the way in which this organism has changed since 9/11 or has changed in the last 20 years. You know, Eisenhower spoke in 1956 about something called the military-industrial complex. And that complex really doesn't exist anymore, or at least it's not the one that exerts the greatest influence in this world. Now we live with a military information complex. Information is far more important than bending metal, and that's where most of the money goes. And the amount of people that is required to collect all of the information that's collected, to process all of that information, and I mean here like in the world of IT, and then to analyze that information and to move it around, to store it, to secure it, that's the new military-industrial complex. And that is dominated and absolutely dependent upon the companies, the private companies, the profit-making companies that work in this field. And if you're a profit-making company working either for your shareholders or for your owners, there's no incentive on your part to save money or to suggest that the work that you're doing isn't needed or redundant. Your objective is to make money for your company, and so we have surrendered a gigantic portion of the national security work of our nation to a profit-making organization, to a profit-making establishment that essentially has no interest whatsoever in auditing itself.
Just for people who might have just tuned in, I'd like to introduce again our guest, William Arkin. He's a columnist for The Washington Post, has been since 1998, and he has written a lot about the U.S. military and about national security. He's the co-author, along with Dana Priest, who is also a reporter for The Post, of the book Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. This is a book fairly recently published that is expanded version of some articles that the two of them wrote together for The Post. The book is published by Little Brown. Their articles are still available on The Post website if you would like to read them. Questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm just interested in going back for a moment here to this shift from the industrial military to the information military and thinking about the fact that one of the ways that the old industrial military and in its budget was supported is that defense contractors were spread all over the place. You know, the idea was build a broad constituency for that budget by having many different members of Congress being able to say, well, this means jobs in my state, so I'm going to vote for this. There apparently also has been a big change here that the distribution pattern of the spending is nothing like what it was during the Cold War.
Well, basically that's true. Why we even use the term Top Secret America and why we thought that was an appropriate description of sort of the hidden geography of the United States today was that if you looked at this national security establishment geographically, it revealed many things about itself. Certainly the most important was how important Washington was. Now, that's a no-brainer, I guess, to some people. But really, what was most interesting to us that we found that 6 of the 10 wealthiest counties in America by per capita income were in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. That compared with 1 prior to 9/11. We discovered that most of the major corporations who are the highest on the lists of federal and defense contractors, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, SAIC, Mantech, CACI, even Boeing, which is a Chicago-based company, were moving their headquarters, not just their defense business, not just their government contracting business, but their corporate headquarters to the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, because that was where the action was and that was where the money was. Arlington, Virginia, the county where the Pentagon is located, has the lowest unemployment rate in the United States. So there really is a Washington, and then there is the rest of the country. I mean, it is economically and demographically proven today, and that's really been accentuated with the post-9/11 changes. But beyond that, we found clusters, Aurora, Colorado, Tampa, Florida, new places that were these epicenters of military activity, one clustered around Baltimore Washington International Airport in Fort Meade, Maryland, where they are the new military towns, if you will, supplanting the Norfolks and the San Diegos of old. They're the places where really the information is most crucially processed and moved. And in that regard, the geography also of the spending has shifted.
We have a caller here. We'd welcome others. Again, our numbers here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll start out here with someone who is in Thomasboro, and they're line number 1. Hello.
Hey, Bill. Good morning. Doug Rocky, how are you?
Good.
Hey, Bill?
Yeah?
Yes?
Yes, Doug Rocky, how you been?
Good.
Hey, I was wondering, could you talk about how, you know, the stuff we've learned with all the corporations, how as they gather the intel, assess the intel, report the intel, is used to, you know, set up preconceived notions, ideas, concepts, and plans?
Well, you know, one of the things that happens in a world of information and intelligence where you're so focused on the question of the enemy, the nature of the enemy, and therefore That is what determines how much money should be spent. Because, you know, you have to, in some way, even in the war on terrorism, say that whatever our investments should be are investments that should be commensurate with what the threat is that by putting more and more money, if you will, but more and more resources into the intelligence establishment that is run by corporations, you're getting less and less of an incentive to have a truthful answer to that question. And I say that because I don't think the nation as a whole has done a very good job of answering the question, what is the threat from Al-Qaeda or what is the threat from intelligence? I really think that what you have is a situation where we've just made some assumptions post 9/11 that we continue to hold on to. And, you know, the real question, I guess, for anyone, you know, whether it's a super committee in Washington or a citizen sitting in Illinois is, you know, is government spending commensurate with what is the need? And I would say not only is it not, but that because of this corporate shift and because of the shift to intelligence as opposed to a military-based system where the military is far more transparent than intelligence is, there's less of an incentive and less information available in order for the citizenry to make that assessment.
Yeah, boy, total right on. I guess the second question, and we talked about this before and stuff we've worked on, how do we get individuals to actually truly look at what's happening rather than live with the myths and the ideas that they've held for so many years? And then I'll hang up. Anyhow, Bill, thanks a lot. Great work. Continue your work.
Okay, thank you.
Well, you know, I'm actually kind of optimistic about the people. To me, what's going on in Occupy Wall Street or what's going on in the Tea Party is practically synonymous when it comes to their distrust for the federal government and their intuitive understanding of the fact that the economic justice that exists in our society is completely wrong. I also thought it was interesting that when our articles originally came out last year and then when our book came out this year, you know, we could have been heavily criticized by the right for revealing the nation's secrets, or criticized as both of us have been in the past for revealing national security. And yet, that criticism has been non-existent or extremely muted. And that just tells me that everybody gets it, that they get it, that something really has happened since 9/11, and that we're barely on the curve back to repairing whatever it is. And most people also get, whether they're on the left or the right, that the Obama administration has done very little to change the structure of national security. So in this regard, I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic in the sense that the people get it. I'm pessimistic in the sense that Washington has become an even more insulated and self-interested town.
You know, well, we were spending a lot of money and putting a lot of emphasis on national defense during the Cold War. And I think, and you can correct me if this is wrong, but I think that actually during the Cold War there were even more people with security clearance than there are now. Now, if terrorism is the big threat we face now, and one might argue whether or not in fact it is, if we even say it's a significant threat, well, then how do you make this determination? What is the right amount to be spending and the right number of people to be working on the issue?
Well, it's a great question, and I think that it's an incredibly complex calculation. You know, on the one hand, what you say about the Cold War compared to today is correct. However, in an industrial system, you employ a lot more people intrinsically. So in order to manufacture all of those aircraft carriers and missiles and bombers and airplanes of the Cold War era, thousands upon thousands, hundreds of thousands upon hundreds of thousands of industrial workers were required to do the job. Now, our military is, a fifth of the size that it was at the height of the Cold War, and the intelligence establishment is probably twice the size that it was during the Cold War. Well, what does that tell you? It tells you that there's been this significant shift. And if the shift is in the areas that are the most secret, then certainly we're not going to be able to have the same kind of discussion or debate about what should be done. Now, on the question of the threat, I do believe that there has to be some cost-benefit analysis of what we need in order to battle terrorism. Terrorism is not the only threat to the United States, but from 2001 until, you know, for the next 5 or 6 years, it seemed like it was the only threat. I mean, it is the case that President Bush went to West Point to deliver a commencement address in 2002, in which he declared the threat of terrorism to be as great as, if not more dangerous than, Nazi Germany or Soviet Union during a nuclear war. Now, I think the threat of terrorism is real. But to argue that terrorism in some way could destroy our nation or destroy our planet is just absurd. And that's the kind of rhetoric that has accompanied the war on terrorism that makes it more difficult for us to be able to assess how much is enough.
Hmm. How much of this growth do you think has to do with the fact that no one in government, not in the Pentagon, not in Congress, not in the CIA, nowhere, no one would want to be the person of whom it could be said, because this guy decided we could shave some money off the budget, we had people die as a result of terrorism?
Well, I think there is some sense of the fact that nobody wants to be the first to say, you know, we can cut back. There is that. Mm-hmm. And I certainly think that the entire national security community, you know, sort of subsists on the basis of the fact that that there's been no 9/11 since 9/11, even though many more soldiers have died in Iraq and Afghanistan, to ensure that that is the case. So if you're just counting bodies, you know, that's an odd claim to be making. So yes, there isn't much of an incentive. But I would separate in the minds of your listeners whether or not anyone in the government believes that something can be done about it, and whether anybody in the Congress believes that something can be done about it. And you know, the public's opinion of Congress is pretty low these days, but they are still the entity of our system that are responsible for the public treasury and for overseeing the executive branch, and they've just done a miserable job of cheerleading and not overseeing since 9/11.
All right, let's talk with another caller, Champaign County, here where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, this is so extremely pernicious to our democracy to have all this high-level stuff outsourced the way it is. But as you say, the Congress isn't even very good at overseeing the official agencies like the CIA. So it's a daunting situation. I have read a couple books on this that I haven't actually looked at yours. I looked at the website yet. But Spies for Hire has a lot about all of this, Tim Shorrock's book. And I wanted to ask some questions about SAIC, since I think it originated here and it still has a rather large presence here at the research park at the U of I. They don't have a good track record. Trailblazer was an awful disaster of a contract, which was supposed to, I think, be an integrative computer system for all of the intelligence agencies. Maybe that was a non-software problem. Maybe it was turf. But there's a program called Deep Green, which is an integrative battlefield software, sort of a control. It gives some people worries about roboticizing the battlefield and person in, person out, autonomous systems kind of thing, which I think is not trivial. So I wanted you to chew that over a while, if you would, and what do you think about that? Those kind of concerns, the whole list.
Well, I think the two of the concerns that you mentioned, one is the robotization of the battlefield, and two is the use of all of this information that is being collected, are good ones and important ones for us to ponder. You know, we all know that the shift of the emphasis of the war on terrorism, at least in places like Pakistan and Yemen and other places, has been towards drones, unmanned aircraft that are used to both conduct surveillance and, in fact, conduct assassinations from the air of suspected terrorists. Before this year, I would have said this is a philosophical problem. This year, I'll say it's a constitutional problem because the U.S. government decided this year to summarily execute an American citizen without providing him due process of law. And I think that that's a should be a crisis in our country and something on the top of everybody's mind when the U.S. government can decide to do that. On the question of where all this information is going and how is it being collected and what's being done with it, I think that you just have to shift your focus and think about all of the things that you experience in your day-to-day lives to understand really what's going on in the intelligence world, the cloud and broadband and how much cheaper it is for you to put a hard drive into your computer or laptop or how powerful a smartphone is. I mean, these are all of the telltale signs of what's going on in the intelligence world as well. And in each case, what we're seeing is more and more data being collected, more and more data being processed, more and more data being stored, with really no clear evidence that it's doing anything other than making it better for the actual guys with the guns to kill people. It's not making us smarter in terms of understanding the Islamic world. It's not making us more strategic in terms of understanding what it is that we need to do to win this battle of hearts and minds that everybody always talks about and never does anything about. It's not helping us to tame the information anymore. In fact, that's why this sort of is an unlimited world, this top secret America. It's unlimited because in the world of information, there are no limits. At least in the case of missiles or bombers or even nuclear warheads, there were limits at some point. There were limits on how many you could build, how many you could move, how many you could carry. Even there were limits on how much material was available, plutonium, uranium, et cetera. But when you start talking about zeros and ones, there's no limit. There's no limit. And as a result of that, we now have our sort of infinite world of counterterrorism. Hmm.
And it also, I think one of the points that you make about all this gathering of information is that not only is there no one who looks at everything, but even within a particular agency, say, pick something like the CIA, even within the CIA, the director of the CIA, he doesn't see everything that the CIA gathers. I'm not sure that there is anyone who really does. So there's such a volume of stuff. It's just too much for anybody to absorb, or maybe even for a single organization to absorb.
Hey, look, in my household, there are four laptop computers, two desktop computers, and four smartphones. No, I can't keep a track of all of that. I don't know where all my own digital pictures are. Now let's multiply that by a million. So it's a human problem. We all experience it and face it every day. But I think the next step in this is that we have to turn that intuitive human problem into one of limits. The only way that the intelligence community and the national security establishment is going to have any incentive to reform itself post 9/11, and to try to come up with an organization, a scheme, and a priority list that limits it is going to be if we take away its money.
Our guest in this hour of focus is William Arkin. He's a columnist for the Washington Post. He is the co-author, along with Dana Priest, also from the Post, of the book Top Secret America: The Rise of the New American Security State. We'll talk some more in just a moment. First, a short break. This is Focus.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Burlingame Home Inspection and Performance. Burlingame performs property inspections along with energy audits and ratings for Energy Star, tax credits, and efficiency mortgages, all utilizing infrared technology. More information is at CUSaveEnergy.com or 217-649-1173.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with 10 different topics for you every week. We try to put a lot of variety into the show. Hope that there's at least a few things that will draw your interest. In the second part of the program today, Celeste Quinn will be in the hosting chair, and she will be talking with two guests about politics in Springfield, looking at things like budget shortfalls, tax policy, gaming, public pensions, all of those issues that remain on the table at the State House. She'll be talking with two Illinois political scientists, Chris Mooney and Brian Gaines, about what has happened recently there in Springfield and what didn't, and also talk about what might happen when the legislature returns to the Capitol next week. That's in the second hour of Focus today. You can check on the schedule, find out what we will do in the days ahead, by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. You can also listen to past programs there on our web archive. In this hour of Focus, the guest is William Arkin. He's a columnist for The Washington Post. He also has written many books about, either authored or co-authored, more than a dozen books about U.S. military and national security. He is the co-author, along with Dana Priest, who is also a reporter for The Post, of the book Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. That's a subtitle. It is published by Little Brown, and it is an expansion on some articles, a series of articles with that topic, that title, Top Secret America, that were published in The Post, that Dana Priest and William Arkin wrote together. And you can go out and you can look for the book. Also, you can read their articles. They're still there on the Post website. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with another caller here in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Mr. Arkin.
Yes.
In the past, I think, 2 or 3 weeks, NPR reported that some of the most supposedly secure computer systems at the Pentagon were hacked. What is your reaction to that?
Well, you know, as somebody who's been in this business for 3 decades, whenever I hear stories like this, I remember the last 700,000 times I heard the same story. So I do suffer a bit from the cynicism of repetition here. I will say this, though. We spend well over $10 billion a year in our national security establishment on just security. So that means just security clearances, security devices, security, the maintenance of security, and that amount is increasing enormously in the information era. And yet it seems like the very people that we charge with securing our secrets are not capable of doing so. At least that's what the news says. Now, let me take another perspective, because on the one hand, as I reminded the questioner, I've heard it all before. On the other hand, I also think of the Three Stooges episode. And it's the Three Stooges episode in which they decide that they're going to be rat catchers.
Oh.
And the way in which they are going to catch rats is they're going to put rats all throughout the neighborhood, and then they're going to knock on doors and offer to get rid of them. Well, there is a bit of that in my mind when it comes to this whole world of cybersecurity. Right. Do I believe that China is heavily engaged in cyber espionage and in attempts to penetrate our computer systems? Absolutely. So are we of them. And do I believe that there is a war going on that is multinational and includes even terrorist organizations? I do. But I don't see it any different than I see any other spy versus spy escapade during the Cold War. And I say, as I've always said, it's really important that we say to these security guys, you can only get so much if you constantly tell us that the threat is there and that your systems are being penetrated, because we gave you money before to secure them. And it's just not infinite. It's not endless. At some point, someone has to be accountable when this process continuously rears its head. And we live in a system today where no one is ever held responsible for their failures. All we end up doing is writing another check.
Thank you for those comments.
All right, thank you. We'll go on and talk again here with somebody on our line number 3, and they are in Champaign. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Good morning. Good
yeah.
morning. I start listening a little bit late. I hope I'm on the right. The gentleman is very honest and very with a lot of knowledge. Terrorism is a myth. Terrorism was created and always has been by the U.S. State Department, by London, by Tel Aviv, just to promote the New World Order agenda and to make excuses for more killing and more wars abroad. When I hear flag wavers and chanting slogans, thank you for defending my freedom abroad, it's just disgusting. I don't want my freedom to be defended abroad when my freedom in the country here is taken away. 900 military bases in 170 countries around the world, $15 trillion in debt. That's not freedom. This is defending the corporate and the banking scams. And this is, of course, paid by American taxpayers at the most. And, of course, the other people, when they're raped and killed over there and their treasuries are taken away by global oligarchs, they say also that without the support of the U.S. military, this New World Order crimes cannot exist, cannot succeed. United States is supporting dictatorships all around the world as long as they're promoting their agendas and their U.S. Constitution says that our military has to be in the borders, protecting our borders. There is no terrorist organization being able to attack the United States if we have our military here in the borders, what the Constitution says.
I don't know. I'm going to jump in here. It was a little difficult to understand the caller. I don't know if you got the basic point and how you might want to respond.
Well, I did get the basic point, and I'll paraphrase it, which is that there is no threat of terrorism, that it's self-generated by the U.S. system, and unfortunately, the caller is wrong. Would love that world to be what he describes it to be, but it's not. There are a lot of people out there who wish us harm, who wish the West harm, who wish that there were a battle to the end between Islam and the rest of the world, and many of them take up arms and do so illegally. The interesting thing that struck me when I was hearing the caller was that we speak of it in military intelligence terms, as we had even today in this interview, and have never mentioned the FBI, never mentioned law enforcement, which is a part of the system, but yet at the same time it's one that has been really shoved to the side since 9/11. We think of the CIA as the entity that's battling terrorism, or the military and special operations forces as the entity that's battling terrorism, and I want to see more law enforcement. This is a basic question of law enforcement, of a universal rule of law, and an application of the rule of law that makes it possible for us to apprehend and try people who are engaged in terrorism. Now, you might say, well, that's impossible to do or difficult to do, and I would say to you, well, it's not impossible and it's not too difficult because it's been successfully done in many cases. And the pretension that sort of arose after 9/11 was, oh, the FBI, you know, they just wait until something bad has happened and then they go and try to find the perps. Well, the CIA's answer to that was, we're going to go out there and we're going to stop it from happening in the first place, thereby throwing aside this whole question of law enforcement. Well, I don't think the CIA and the military and the special ops people have particularly been very successful in this endeavor. Well, let's put it this way. They have been successful in this endeavor, but what are they promising? They're promising what they call the long war, that this is going to go on forever, that this is the world we live in forever. And I think under those circumstances, then, what we're essentially communicating to those who would wish us harm, those who would attack civilians, those who would take up arms illegally, that there are no laws anymore, that it's all about war. And when we do that, then we are definitely breeding more terrorists and breeding more people who think that they have the right and the need to take matters into their own hands. So a key part for me of changing the post-9/11 aesthetic about in Top Secret America and about the war on terrorism would be taking the CIA and the military more out of this so-called war and putting the so-called war more under law enforcement authorities where it properly resides.
I want to ask you a little bit different question then, and people will remember certainly after 9/11 with all of the inquiry into how it was that it happened and how it was that the United States government failed to detect and foil this plot. There was a lot of talk about the fact that because of poor communication and turf battles between different organizations like CIA, FBI, NSA, and so forth, that the problem was that people might have had little bits of information that didn't mean a whole lot in and of themselves. But if you could take all that information and put it all together, that a pattern would emerge. And this was the so-called connecting the dots problem. And that was, I think, something that the creation of the Director of National Intelligence was at least supposed to address. So if I ask you the question, are we any better today at doing this, at collating information that different people collect so that we can get it all together and see what it means? Are we any better at that now than we were before 9/11?
Well, the answer is yes, but it's like painting your house. It's not a one-time shot. And as we saw, say, for instance, with the underwear bomber of Christmas 2010, the reality is that that the dots weren't connected. They had the information. It wasn't moved around. The agencies still weren't talking with each other. And if that's the case, then while we can be somewhat more at ease that the border security and the airline security of the United States has improved, I'm afraid, like painting a house, that we may not be looking at the termites or the rot that's occurring somewhere else because, of course, terrorists are not going to just waltz into Logan Airport or Dulles Airport next time to conduct a spectacular attack against the United States. They're going to try some other way in which they have detected a vulnerability that exists in our society. So I on the one hand, I know that progress has been made. I've sat in many briefings. I've visited many of these government agencies. I am studying the technologies and the people involved. Many of my friends work in this business. I know that they do better. The learning curve is real and it's improved. I just don't know whether or not they can fulfill the expectation of there never being another spectacular terrorist attack in the United States. And I wonder whether or not in their endeavor to do so, or particularly in our Wild West headhunting, get them one at a time drone war that we're currently conducting in the Middle East, that we are ever going to see an end to this war.
Well, that, I think you point to something that is an important issue here and something that I think you do deal with in the book, and that is whether part of the problem here is this zero-tolerance terrorism posture that the government took after 9/11. And when they said not only did they want to make sure that nothing on the scale of 9/11 ever happened again, but they also said we're going to stop every plot by every single lone wolf operator. No one will be able to do 9/11 again, but even no one will be able to set off, you know, one individual will not be able to set off one bomb. And it seems that you're arguing that maybe that was a promise that should not have been made, and that the government can't promise that level of security.
Well, it can't, and as we've seen, it can't. I mean, everybody will probably note that there's going to be a withdrawal of all of our combat troops from Iraq at the end of this year and from Afghanistan probably at the end of 2014. That certainly means that those who wish to do us harm are going to have to focus their attention somewhere else, and certainly we are more vulnerable in the United States than we are when you're talking about military bases and formations overseas. So the problem is, where does it end? It's not necessarily whether they're doing better, whether we're spending too much money, but what's our strategic thrust? What's our national objective here in dealing with this problem of terrorism? And I think it needs to be multifaceted, starting with looking really honestly at what it is that we do in the world that is a stimulus for terrorism, and then secondly, where we should be applying our resources to best defend ourselves against something that's not going to go away. I would say I'd prefer to see make sure that our airline security and border security and things like that are the best that they can be. But now, just taking one agency which has been created since 9/11. The TSA, Transportation Security Administration, the agency everyone loves to hate, you know, they've got 700,000 security people. Do we need that many?
Yeah.
Can't we have better technologies that achieve this goal? Is this really the primary threat that we suffer from, that we need to spend our money and energy on? And that kind of reevaluation as things change just isn't happening.
We have maybe about 5 minutes left in this hour of Focus. Our guest is William Arkin. He's a columnist for The Washington Post. He's the co-author with Dana Priest of the book Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. It is published by Little Brown. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. And you can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Is there, do you think, anyone in Washington who could be the person to stand up and say, look, we all want to be secure. I want this country to be secure. But at the same time, we should take a cold, hard look at how much money we're spending and how we're spending it, and asking the simple question, are we getting our money's worth? Is this money well spent? And you know, not only are we gaining any information, but are we actually wasting money here and possibly making ourselves less secure? Is there anyone who could actually stand up and say that?
Right now, not really. I mean, could the President of the United States said it in January 2 years ago when he first came into office? You know, I suppose, and I suppose, you know, that a chairman of some committee who wasn't engaged in the raucous partisan battles of the day could as well. It's just not happening. It's just not happening. And my guess is that it's not happening because that there's an environment of fear that sort of makes it possible not to happen. That terrorism somehow has taken on a sort of psychological position in our lives that makes it difficult to happen. I mean, even during the worst days of the Cold War, when there were thousands upon thousands of nuclear weapons pointed at the United States, there was a vibrant intellectual debate about how much was enough and how we could solve the problem. And I'm afraid that debate just doesn't exist right now. It doesn't exist at the universities. It doesn't exist in the think tanks. It doesn't exist in our society. And the only thing really that gives me hope is that when I look at Occupy Wall Street, or I look at the Tea Party, or I look at people's unhappiness with government, I come to the conclusion that the people get it. They just don't have anybody to represent their interests.
All right. We have at least one more caller here. Spring Bay, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Conversation has started me thinking about the money we spend on conventional force is really, I think, contributing to the response, which is asymmetrical warfare. People would be idiots like Saddam to line their tanks up in the desert and take us on conventionally, and so the only avenue left to them is asymmetrical tactics. So that perhaps the more money we spend, the some ways less secure we become. Now I'll get off and listen to your response. Thank you.
Is that something that you can talk about?
Yes. I mean, when we say asymmetrical warfare, a word that has become popular post 9/11 but existed before, it's indirect warfare. It's if you're going to be standing there with a gun and I have a smaller gun, then I'm going to have to defeat you with some other means. You know, this goes all the way back to 5th century Sun Tzu type philosophers. But I do think that there's some truth to what the caller said in terms of just understanding that we need to be much more mindful of the implications of our own actions. We need to be much more mindful of what our position in the world and our posture in the world actually means to others, not just what it means to us. And we don't do a very good job of that. And 10 years after 9/11, the fact that we're still saying we're going to fight that war of hearts and minds, we're going to win that battle of hearts and minds when we've done so miserably over the last decade, just makes me feel like maybe we don't get it.
Hmm. We're just almost out of time. We have maybe about a minute or so. I guess, again, going back to the question of how it is we get a handle on this, I wonder whether you think it's possible that the spending problem that they're wrestling with in Washington and the need to cut spending, whether that might be the only thing that might make some difference. Of course, we also see some pushback. For example, there's talk of cutting back Pentagon spending and a lot of pushback from the Secretary of Defense. Is it possible that the cold, hard reality of simply not having enough money would make some difference?
I think it would make a difference, and I think it, to some degree, it already has. I mean, either through our series in the Washington Post embarrassing the Secretary of Defense in getting him to say on the record that he didn't even know how many contractors worked for his own office has provoked them to look more closely at these numbers and to try to get a greater handle on it. I just don't see an executive branch or a congressional commitment, though, to reducing national security spending in any reasonable way. And in fact, it's used as sort of the nuclear button to say, you know, we can't reduce it all. And, you know, we have to somehow sequester that $1 trillion that we're spending on this area. So there are ways in which I think we could move forward, but greater transparency obviously is step number one. But I don't see the leadership or the will to do so at this time.
Our guest in this hour of focus is William Arkin. He's a columnist with The Washington Post, and he is the co-author, along with Dana Priest, who is investigative reporter for The Post. They are the authors of the book Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. It is published by Little Brown, recently out. You can find it in the bookstore. You can also read their articles on the website of The Washington Post. Mr. Arkin, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me on today.